don't bet against AI. It's getting better. And I think we will have to adapt and we'll have to figure out how to use it as a tool. But we're going to also have to make sure that it's trustworthy, just like you wouldn't hire an employee to start writing code for you if you didn't trust them.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello, and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly security podcast, where we break down the most important stories in the field with the help of our panel of experts. I'm your host, Brian Clark. I'll be standing in for Matt Kaczynski this week. Joining me today are three returning panelists: Michelle Alvarez, Manager, X-Force Strategic Threat Analysis; Sridhar Mupidi, IBM Fellow, CTO, IBM Security; and Jeff Kroon, Distinguished Engineer, Master Inventor, AI and Data Security. All right, here's what we're talking about this week. How will AI transform the SOC? Can we trust AI agents to fix vulnerable code? And payroll pirates are sailing the high seas. But first, RIP Windows 10. Hundreds of millions of people still use Windows 10, and many PCs don't meet Microsoft's strong requirements for Windows 11. This brings about the question, should I spend the money on a new PC or save a couple of bucks in the short run but remain vulnerable to attacks? So the first question we'll start with is, what kinds of security issues might this introduce for people and organizations? Let's go to Michelle. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this one.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. So hopefully last week wasn't the first time that organizations and individuals heard about the end of life. I think the announcement originally came out maybe over a year and a half ago. So hopefully organizations have been putting steps in place to prepare for this end of life. So I like to liken it to maybe something that everybody can relate to, and that's our cars, right? We have warranties on our cars that eventually come to end of life. So you have a choice. Do you extend the warranty? That would be the same as extended security updates offered by Microsoft. Do you maybe trade in your vehicle for a newer model that could be Windows 11? Or are you contemplating purchasing a whole new car, different make and model, and that would be alternate operating systems? So I think organizations have a lot of things to consider when an operating system comes to life, but the important thing is to make sure that you're setting up for success, preparing early so that business continuity is there when the platform becomes end of life.
Exactly. So there's a lot of different choices, but the main thing to take away is you need to do something, right?
Or you could do nothing. There's always that choice, do nothing.
Right. That might not be the best choice, but that is a choice, right?
I think it's probably start thinking about it as a business risk, right? I mean, to your point, Michelle, right? It's about business. In some cases, you may have to do something. In other cases, probably it's okay to patch it or buy extended support, or in some cases, probably circumvent it with additional controls like network isolation or extra monitoring. But I think if you start looking at it as a risk-based approach, I think the choice becomes really clear on what the options are and how do we go about it.
I think it's appropriate, yeah, just in time for Halloween. Now we get all these zombies. So that's what essentially these Windows 10 systems are going to be. They're going to be the living dead that are out there. They're still able to operate and do things, but in fact, they're not up to date. They're going to be vulnerable. They're going to represent a threat to us. And they, in fact, could be leveraged to become what we refer to as zombies or botnets, where you know, somebody takes remote control of a system and then uses it to attack others, to do denial of service, to do other things like that. So we just now, you know, the bad guys just got a lot of fertile ground handed to them, because whenever there are new vulnerabilities that come out, those will be known publicly, but there won't be patches to fix them. So in a sense, it'll be like zero day every day for all of these systems. The unfortunate thing I think about it is that the people that are least likely to have the hardware capable to do the upgrade and least motivated to do it will be the ones that, you know, that will be taken advantage of in this. They're not going to know that they need to do it in many cases. It's just going to be someone that's the family PC and they bought it and they don't want to upgrade every, you know, year or two. It still works from their perspective. So again, like Michelle's analogy with the car, not everybody wants to buy a new car every couple of years. as long as it still works. So it's going to be a big issue. But I think organizations, and to a great extent, even just individuals, have to start planning for obsolescence, because the vendors are doing that. You know, their intention is, of course, to keep adding new features, and new features will require additional hardware and additional capability. It's a big cost for Microsoft to continue supporting down-level software. At what point do they cut it off? Are they supposed to still support Windows 3.1, Windows 95? I mean, at some point they say no. But this does seem, this seems like this is cutting off a lot of folks. There's the estimate's 200 million computers. That's a lot. That's a lot of potential zombies that are about to come alive, you know, here in the next few weeks and years to come.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think I even noticed a startling fact. I'm not sure the validity of it, but 9% of Windows users are still on Windows 7.
This is not a new topic, right? You know, systems have gone out of support for many, many decades. What we've seen is that there's a 90-day window period where attackers are stockpiling exploits for this day, right? So because not everybody is going to Michelle's analogy, sure, let me drive the additional 2 miles before I can do something about it. And that's a window that attackers try to take advantage of to be able to launch some attacks. So something to get started right away as opposed to wait.
Yeah, I think most normal people hate software upgrades. I don't put myself in the category of normal. I'm always, you know, enjoying the new beta. I want the newest features, the newest whatever, but that's not normal. Most people in my family, when the new software comes out for their phones, they're the last ones to update. They're years behind. And then when they come and ask me, the you know, family tech support guy, to fix a thing, I look and see what level of whatever, you know, mobile operating system they're on, and it makes my eyes pop out. But that's not what most people want to do, which means this stuff has to be automated, and it has to be easy, it has to be frictionless, and it's just not when it comes to these cases. And if you look at from the economic standpoint, this is what economists would call an externality for a software vendor. This is not something that benefits them directly. It's something that, you know, why would they want to upgrade all these old systems? It's harder for them. It costs them more to support multiple levels of operating system. They'd rather spend their time developing new features and things like that. So there's a tension, and it won't just resolve itself naturally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we talk about these topics, there's two things we can look at, right? We often speak in terms of organizations and enterprises, because at least for me, that's who I'm often speaking to, right? Our clients. But then, you know, Jeff mentioned and brought it really personal, right? Our family members, our friends. And I think this is where education comes into play, and doing things like these podcasts where we can talk directly to just individuals about your own personal security hygiene and how important it is, because they might see then the benefits to doing the extended warranty or, you know, upgrading to Windows 11. They can now put it into context. Okay, this is significant, this is serious, and this is why.
Move along to our next topic. How will AI transform the SOC? So more and more organizations are introducing AI agents for the SOC. IBM has Atom, and Blumira just dropped one last week called SOC Autofocus. Let's talk about more AI in the SOC. Sridhar, why don't we move to you for the first question. What is AI doing in the SOC now, and what might it do in the future?
If you look at the progression of the SOCs, right? I mean, we've been here for a number of years. We started looking at manual logs to SIM rules to machine learning in their detection. And now we're getting into autonomous agents. So it's a progression, the way I look at it, right? The progression of how SOC analytics are looking at the number of events that we're seeing every day. And what AI helps us is moving from, first of all, just pure AI, it helps us improving the accuracy of detection, right? And increasing the speed of investigation so they can respond faster. Now, what we have to think about is with these agents like Atom and Blumira and other things, we go into the next level where some of the detection is being done by the agents. So the analysts have to move to the higher ground of being able to either validate those or be able to go and look at the events and incidents which are high value, where we may have to not only rely on the speed and the efficiency of the AI, but also couple that with the human ingenuity, creativity, the business context to be able to make something relevant or not relevant and take action quickly.
I'll just say, I think this is necessary. This is a necessary evolution. The number of events, the amount of data that's having to be processed, the amount of time that we have to do the analysis is not working in the favor of the good guys. So we're going to need all the help we can get. The bad guys have AI. The good guys are going to have to use it better. So this is not a surprise. And like Sridhar said, you know, we've been working in this space, developing tools in this space. But it's also an area that's new and we need to go in with caution. So it's great if you have a system that can go do all of this analysis and do this research and take, you know, what would have been hours down into minutes. That's great. As long as, so now you've basically got a security analyst that's working 24/7, that's always up to date on the latest and greatest and can advise you. That's all great as long as it's not hallucinating. So we don't need a security analyst on LSD. It needs to be grounded in truth. It needs to be, when it's seeing something, it needs to be real. And we also have to realize that attackers will find ways to inject information into our systems that will be designed to confuse the AI systems that we're relying on to do the diagnosis. That'll be really clever stuff. So the arms race will continue in both of these cases. So I think it's necessary. I think it's exactly what has to happen, but I think we have to go in with caution. And I think as much as the temptation will be to that AI is doing such a great job with this, let's just let it run things, that we need to keep the human in the loop. When it comes to what systems do we shut down, what things do we block, what, you know, with these kinds of things. Otherwise, it's really easy for us to basically automate a denial of service against ourselves. If we build a system that says, every time I see an attack on this port, shut down that port, well, then the bad guy just has to attack you once on every port and you'll shut everything down for them. They don't have to do it. So we've got to be intelligent with this, and the AI is intelligent to an extent, but there's judgment, and human judgment's still going to be needed in these cases.
Right, right. It's not a you know, a full solve for all the problems in the SOC. It's a tool and needs to be used as such, right?
Yeah, I'm going to jump in on one thing that Jeff said, a key word. It's time. So usually time is not on security team side. It's not on the defender side. It's not on the responder side, because oftentimes what we're seeing are attackers dwelling in environments for long periods of time. And I'm actually going to pull in a very relevant statistic from the cost of a data breach, which I know my fellow panelists are very familiar with. It's a study that IBM does analysis on data and insights pulled from the Ponemon Institute. And this year's report has a lot of great information, especially when it comes to the use of AI in environments. And so security teams using AI and automation extensively, that's another key word, extensively, shortened their breach times by 80 days and lowered their average breach costs by $1.9 million. And that's compared to organizations that did not use AI at all. So it's all about containing the incident, first identifying the incident, right? And then containing and subsequently remediating the incident. And as much as we can shorten that, and with AI as a tool in our belts, not to, you know, completely erase the human oversight, but as a tool to speed up that process and that attacker life cycle gets shorter and shorter, that's to our benefit.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that the trend that I'm seeing with all three of you is keeping that human in the loop, not just removing the human aspect from it. I read a bit about the AI saving a lot of time. And like you mentioned, Michelle, 80 days. So that's a lot less combing through the logs, but we still need somebody there verifying anything that the AI agent is finding. We touched a little bit about on any concerns on introducing AI to the SOC. I can already guess that there are some. among all three of you. Jeff, do you want to elaborate a little bit more about some of the concerns that you were mentioning?
Yeah, so some concerns would be that one that I mentioned is that if someone is able to inject information into the system, there's one type of attack called evasion, where you're able to manipulate the inputs in a way so that it doesn't confuse you or me because we perceive things through certain processes, but AI doesn't use exactly those same processes. So it might see this as something completely different, and you and I would filter some of that information out. So that's an example. If these systems are staying up to date, which we hope they will, then they're going to be scanning the internet. They're going to be using other inputs and feeds like that that are coming in. So again, an attacker might put out, say, a new document that's a fake document that talks about a new type of attack, and inside the document is an indirect prompt injection. And then my system goes out, reads in this new document, tries to process this research, and then the indirect prompt injection, it starts reading instructions that cause it now to start exfiltrating or doing other kinds of things like that. You could plant things in information that later gets sucked into models, and then it stays in the model for a long time until somebody realizes, oh, this model's been poisoned. You know, what are we going to do about that? So those are just a few examples, but there's a lot. And I think a lot of organizations, the temptation will be, oh, we can save a lot of money. We can just bring in this AI and we can start laying people off. We don't need people because we've got AI. And I'm just going to say, resist that temptation. There's always going to be enough work in the SOC, I think, at least for the foreseeable future, regardless of how good our tools get. I don't think we ever get to a point where we say, okay, you know what, everybody just take the week off. We're ahead. No, this is a line of work you never get ahead in. So you're always going to need to be focusing, using human intelligence, augmenting it with AI, just in order to keep your head above water. That's not even getting ahead.
One thing I want to mention is I know we've been heavily focused on human and AI partnership, right? I think we've been talking about it. I think the one thing that I want to highlight is even in the AI part, right, we need to think about the explainability, right? And can basically say, block this IP address, but block this IP address because of this following TTP, building on Jeff's example, or this threat intel, or this behavioral pattern, so that you can make an informed decision and not be subject to some of the prompt injection attacks in between, right? So yes, absolutely important for human and AI and agent partnership, or what industry is calling is digital workers. But at the same time, the onus is on the agent to ensure that it is not autonomously creating decisions without validation, not subject to some malicious coerceness by attackers, drifting with time, right? Like, you know, AI and agents specifically are non-deterministic and uncertainty, right? So it's possible, and Jeff was alluding to some of the examples of evasion, this poisoning, this stealing. It's like asking 20 questions that we play in a car game. You can ask the 20 questions to AI and figure out what the model is doing and then be able to make it drift, right? So these are the things that we should inherently protect the AI in addition to humans.
That's a great point. Michelle, any final thoughts on this topic?
What Sridhar mentioned about the human-AI connection or partnership, I think really resonates with a lot of security teams that are sort of trying to find that balance between what does AI do versus what does the human do? And we still need the level 2 and level 3 analysts and above to be able to learn from somewhere. So completely kind of cutting out that first level, I don't think is going to be ideal. I think we need to figure out a way to, again, marry those two things and build that partnership where we're able to build our human analysts to a 2, 3 and beyond, and not cut out that first layer, which is so important. Where do you build your skills from? It's from that entry level position as well.
Moving on to our next topic for today, involves Google introducing CodeMender, an AI agent for code security. Earlier this month, Google introduced the agent designed to fix and find flaws in code. So our first question is, are we ready to trust AI with that job? Jeff, let's start it off with you.
So this, I think, is another necessary and foreseeable step, an evolution that we're going along here. AI, we've been using AI for a number of years, machine learning and other types of technologies, to do identification of vulnerabilities in code, to scan source code, to try to hack away at systems and things like that. So that's not surprising. The sort of, and even have it suggest replacements. You know, here I found a vulnerability. Here's a code snippet that I recommend. This is the next step in that, where it's actually doing the repair. It's actually injecting the new code and changing it around. And here's where I'm not going to say we shouldn't do it. I'm going to say we should tap the brakes, or at least make sure we have good oversight. This is going to be back to the human in the loop kind of comment again. Imagine if someone is able to, these AIs, they're based on models. And again, if somebody got in and was able to poison a model and make it so that you now have a code mender, a piece of code that's going to go fix your code, then what if it injects what is a backdoor into your system? If I'm blindly trusting that it found the vulnerability and fixed it, because in fact, probably 90% of the time it'll do great. And then there'll be these few edge cases where, who knows, there's a backdoor, there's a Trojan horse, there's some other unexpected behavior that might happen from this. Or in some cases, again, we have hallucination issues where it might not be intentional. It just might be the nature of the situation, of the system. You know, foundation models, large language models, these kinds of things. We still have not solved hallucinations. We've gotten them better, but I don't want, just like I didn't want a SOC analyst on LSD, I don't want a coder on LSD either, writing code and putting that into my system.
No, I think LSD, somebody's, Jeff.
I'm against that. Let's just say in this context, so I'm definitely not for it. So what are we going to, so there needs to be some oversight. Who's going to be watching this system? And the longer term effect is the part that actually is more troubling to me if we don't get it right. And because this can be a double-edged sword, it can help us, it can hurt us. So as it gets better and better, as I expect it will, we'll become more and more dependent. And then will we have enough people that understand how to read this stuff? If I have an AI system that is writing code, it'll be writing the code for the next generation AI system, which then will create the code for the next generation AI system. These AI systems will be creating their successive generations, which is great. But eventually, it's going to start writing code that might not make sense to us anymore. And now we're having to trust a system that's very opaque, and we're going to use it to do its own debugging. That's a lot of trust. So I would just say we're going to need to adopt the kind of zero trust mentality of verify, then trust, not trust and then verify.
Yeah. Jeff is stealing the Michelle, thunder that's in my head. So I actually...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
I hear it.
It's great. I'm glad we're thinking alike. But I thought to myself, are we going from zero trust to 100 trust just because AI is involved? I don't think so, right? And I also thought if I could phone a friend during this podcast, I would call our X-Force Red Team, which is our pen testers, our hackers, to kind of get their POV on this because I'd be very interested. So I had to kind of put this in perspective of like my wheelhouse and threat intelligence. And when we do, for instance, a report for a client looking at their threat landscape based on their industry, their geography, and what is our, I guess, risk tolerance for putting out a report maybe that has a missing Oxford comma, right? There's a lot of people that love their Oxford commas. And what if this report, because AI looked at it or produced part of it, missed a comma? But what if it made the wrong attribution to the most likely threat actors targeting this organization? That's a huge mistake. So I think, again, what is the risk tolerance? And I guess the theme for this podcast is yes to AI. Let's make sure there's human oversight.
We're not obsolete yet.
Thank you. I hope not. My pickleball career is not taken off yet, so I don't know.
Okay. Well, AI will free you up to play more pickleball.
Yeah, that's the hope, right?
I actually welcome, like Jeff said, right? I welcome the the automation in patch management, right? And not just automation, but be able to go and scan for dynamic testing, static testing, and eventually I'm assuming some blue teaming and red teaming or the vice versa, right? Purple teaming concepts over here. I think both my colleagues said things around human in the loop, you know, verification and all of that is great, right? The couple of things I would mention is it's not about just the AI, but it's also moving to trusting the processes, right? Do we have the right processes in place so that we can do the right level of validation? Because I think, Jeff, you were mentioning there's going to be code that we're not going to be able to, you know, take a look at it at every granular level. There's going to be millions of code. Even you know, what Google has claimed, I believe they've done close to what, 72 or 100, around 75 fixes in 6 months with millions of lines of code, right? Nobody's reading that. But what's the process? What's the process to review? What's the process to test it? What's the automation that we put in there so that we can then go validate that, not by a human just clicking yes or no, but having an automated process in place to match the rate and pace of AI-based, you know, patch management.
That's a great point. And we touched on this a bit, but Google states that right now all the patches by CodeMender are reviewed by researchers before they're put into place. How long do we think before researchers are no longer taking a look at these and the AI system is able to just go ahead and put the patches in place and move along without anybody reviewing them? Do we have any estimates of how far off we might be?
I don't think anybody has looked at every line of 2.5 million lines of code. All right. There's got to be a mechanism by which we have to evolve, right? Human analysis has to evolve to be able to go and put some automated ways of validation. For example, right? And, you know, Jeff was talking about poisoning and evasion in the last topic, right? Let's go by that thread. If AI becomes rogue, we need a mechanism, to Michelle's point, to automate the red teaming, to create an agent which is a red team that can go and launch an automated testing of the code at the entire system level, not just at the AI, not just at the MCP, not just as a server, but the entire end-to-end, right? And once you do that, then I foresee an automated blue agent, which is able to go based on what we found out, be able to automatically fix those, and then do it in a continuous manner. You know, how far are we from that? I think research is we're already looking at those concepts. But to get it to a level of maturity, I think it's going to take some validation and, more importantly, trust.
I think it actually could be done now, but like Sridhar said, it's not ready for prime time. There are too many gaps, too many things that we don't understand, too many things that could be introduced that I wouldn't feel comfortable with it. But here's the thing. Whenever people make predictions about, well, AI is never going to do this, it's doing this, but it'll never do that. I recently did a video on this on the IBM Technology Channel. My take on that is don't bet against AI, because most of the things that people have predicted it was never going to do, it's done. I'm not saying it'll do everything, and I'm not saying it'll do everything perfectly, and it certainly can't today, but it's getting better. And I think we will have to adapt and we'll have to figure out how to use it as a tool. But we're going to also have to make sure that it's trustworthy, just like you wouldn't hire an employee to start writing code for you if you didn't trust them. You'd need some reason to trust them. And you might want some oversight, you know, some way to test and make sure that what they're introducing is not backdoors and stuff like that. We're going to need the same capability. My guess is we'll use AI to test AI. We'll use another AI to do oversight. And then we have to wonder who's watching the watchers. So this whole thing, you know, becomes a nested problem that recurses on itself. But that's where I think we're moving.
Hope for the best, but prepare for the worst with AI.
Right.
Michelle, anything to add?
No, I just thought to myself, can AI be bribed? Because then we're in trouble.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Yeah. That might be an interesting topic for one of our future
AI.
Podcasts. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
We've been spending a lot of time on trust in this podcast, right? I think we do need to step back and think about it as risk management. I think Jeff said, right, don't shy away because it's not ready. And trust is going to come over time. Something is earned, not like a four buttons that we have to check, right? So we all need to think about risk management, right? Whether it's a previous topic or this topic or, you know, there's going to be concerns. And I think both Jeff as well as Michelle said that the patches will introduce more patches because of the flaws they will create, you know, and we talk about red team and blue team. But I think we need to, number one, think about how do we evolve the AI, which is things like root cause analysis, fixed rationale, validation. That's all technology that has to evolve, right? And then meanwhile, there's a human side of it, which also has to evolve, not just going and rubber stamping, you know, 2,000 or 2 million lines of code per se, but how do you go and evolve the human interaction such that you're doing not only automated testing, code review, but also runtime monitoring and rollback? Because what happens if AI drifts and you realize that it was okay, but it's not okay tomorrow morning, right? We got to be able to roll back, right? So I think about it as risk management.
Finally, our last topic of the day, payroll pirates target employees' salaries. In a new social engineering campaign, scammers impersonate employees to trick HR into routing their salaries into accounts that the scammers control. Since this scam works so well, especially in HR departments, what does it say about the state of enterprise security? Michelle, do you want to lead us off with this one?
Yeah, so essentially in this campaign, it's actually a campaign that we, or a tactic that we've seen for some time now. It's called adversary in the middle attack. And what's happening now is that attackers are able to sort of get around some of the multi-factor authentication methods that are in place. And what we're emphasizing is, and I'm glad Jeff Krum is on the call because I'm going to direct to him next, we're encouraging phishing-resistant MFA methodology and authentication mechanisms. And so I was so excited to see that Jeff was joining the panel because I was like, this is a great topic. We could just kind of just, bring up his latest video on this and spend the next probably half an hour, 40 minutes just on this topic alone. But this is definitely something that we have seen increase as far as incidents and our incident response engagements where attackers are using this type of attack to sort of circumvent, of course, risk mitigations that are in place. And this is, an ongoing battle between defender and attacker where we're putting things in place and they're finding ways around it, but never fear, there's something better that we can be doing to protect our organizations.
Jeff, why don't you take it from here?
Sure.
It seems like
shameless
video plug here.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. Why? I don't need to. I paid Michelle in advance to already plug that video.
There we go.
But
you're all set.
Thank you. Checks in the mail. The thing I thought was interesting about this particular article is it said that they focused a lot on university environments. And I thought, if you're an attacker, look, I'm an adjunct professor at NC State University, and I do it for the love, not for the money, because there's not a ton of money in it, right? And I would just think if I was an attacker and I was trying to siphon off payroll, I'd go somewhere else where there was higher value targets, at least adjuncts are not being paid a ton of money. So that was the first thing. The other thing I thought about, there is a lot of discussion about multi-factor authentication. And it seems in a lot of these cases, MFA was not implemented. And my reaction to that is, did I just sleep through it and we're still in 2005? I thought we were in 2025. What are we still doing with systems that have any importance at all that don't have some form of multi-factor authentication? To me, that's not, there's no excuse for that anymore. We've had years and years. The technology is mature. There's no reason for any system of any real value not to have it. And then as Michelle said, you know, I'm a big advocate of this technology called passkeys as a replacement for passwords, because they're essentially phishing resistant. Now, I'm never going to say it eliminates any attack, but it does a pretty darn good job of reducing that likelihood. These passkeys, and there's a lot of misunderstanding because the first generation of passkeys was a lot more difficult to use. You had to have a special device to carry with you everywhere. Now that special device can, in fact, just be your mobile phone. So the friction on passkeys has come way down. And the number one thing that phishing attacks are going for is your password. Here's one way to make sure they can't steal your password. Don't have one. So have a passkey, which is not easily stolen. And we know how to deal with this. We haven't solved the porch pirate problem, but we can solve the payroll pirate problem.
And I love the fact that both of you are advertising my product, right? But unfortunately, this is not a technical issue. It is not a technical issue. The technical issue has been solved. I think there's multiple ways you can solve this technical issue. It's purely an adoption issue. It's a social engineering issue, right? We've all been here for a number of years, and attacks continue to get sophisticated. And humans always remain the weakest link, right? I think that's what I think we should be focusing on, to say, and a phishing resistance has been there for a while, and I'm seeing organizations talk about the adoption rate of less than 10%. Right? That's my worry, right? That's my worry, to think about focusing on, you know, how do we think about improving the adoption rate over here? And how do we make sure that things are less, effective but more effective in terms of adopting these things, right? So I kind of look at it at two aspects, Jeff and Michelle, right? One aspect is, fine, technology is there. It's not a new technology innovation over here. But number one, you know, how do we teach that? How do we teach that? How do we gamify it? How do we make sure that it is well trusted, et cetera? And the second thing is, we hear, Jeff, and, you know, MFA is not a new topic, like you said, 10, 15 years ago. Adoption is still low. So by this time, we have to accept, to a certain extent, some defeat and agree that we need to evolve the technology to go really assume that these bad things are going to happen. So things like, you know, phishing attacks happen because of email. Do a better job of monitoring email. Be able to go and put some code in rules. Monitor those. Be able to quickly monitor some of the HR systems so that we are able to go and take a quick action. So I'm talking about both education as well as evolution of technology to assume that bad things are going to happen.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I'm glad you brought that up with what Michelle said earlier about education. We can't remove every bit of human error, but we can at least lower that level of human error to the point where it's not as destructive to our organization.
We absolutely should educate users. I think there's a limit to how much we're going to be able to educate them, because the playing field, the attack surface, keeps changing every day, and they can't possibly keep up. AI is going to be one of those things that changes it. You know, we've seen from the cost of a data breach report that Michelle mentioned earlier, the last few years, the number one cause of a data breach has been phishing attacks. Well, if we keep having the same thing year after year, then that means whatever we're doing is not working well enough. Maybe it's working to some degree, but it's not working well enough. We haven't slayed that dragon yet, and we should be able to. We have technology that can help that's not being deployed widely enough. We can train the heck out of users, but they're going to remember some of this stuff, but not others. But for instance, like, we're a victim of our own training in some cases. For years and years on phishing attacks, the advice was look for bad spelling, bad grammar, these kinds of things, and that will be your tip. Well, if AI is writing the phishing attacks, which is what it's going to be happening more and more going forward, it's going to be in perfect English or Spanish or Portuguese or whatever. So there's those kinds of things. We actually need to go unlearn that from people. We need to tell them, ignore that. Now, if you see really bad grammar and it claims to be your bank, well, then probably it's not your bank. But the bottom line is we can't rely on a lot of those kind of cues that we have trained people to in the past. We're going to have to solve a lot of these things so that it's foolproof. Now, that's hard because they keep making better fools all the time. But to the best extent possible, we have to make it so that a user can't do the wrong thing because it's going to be hard to just teach them not to do the wrong. And organizations still keep making, again, these same mistakes. Even if an organization said, we're not doing multi-factor, it's too expensive or whatever, well, I would disagree with them. If they look at the cost of a data breach, multi-factor is pretty darn cheap compared to the alternative. But even if you're going to keep using passwords, at least use the best practice guidelines from someone like the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, which in 2017 changed all the advice that people are still following and enforcing. The things of making people change their password on a regular basis. NIST says no, because that forces people to write them down. The making your password complex. NIST says no, because again, it's forcing people to write their passwords down. You know, length is strength when it comes to passwords, not complexity, because we're looking at the math when we make passwords complex, and we're ignoring the fact there's a human on the other end who can't remember a password. And if they can't remember it, well, then they're going to use the same one everywhere, or they're going to write it down, or other kinds of things. So we've got to think in the security department. We've got to do a better job of making it foolproof so they can't do the wrong thing.
While we have a couple more minutes left, I'd like to touch on something that Jeff brought up earlier about targeting higher education institutions. Do we think that maybe this is a personal vendetta? Because this isn't a place, like Jeff mentioned, that you might be getting the most bang for your buck, I guess, out of an attack, whereas maybe a larger organization or maybe a VIP client or something would be a better target if you're looking to get more money.
My suspicion is no. My suspicion, based on working with a few higher ed clients, is that they don't have the best security. So they're easy targets. They're soft targets. They might not be the highest value targets, but there's a kind of, in the academic world, there's an underwriting current of information wants to be free. So we don't want to put a lot of impediments. We don't want to put a lot of barriers, and security looks like a barrier. So we're kind of against that. And I don't know, maybe information wants to be free, but the company that just paid you a ton of money for that grant, they don't want it to be free. So if you want to keep funding your research, you need to be able to guard this stuff. But I know universities are strapped, so they're doing the best they can. The university that I work for is, I mean, they've had multi-factor authentication for at least the last 5 years that I've been there. So good for them. And I think the others should as well.
One school of thought, right? I mean, I work with a lot of universities as well. And, you know, I understand resources and funding can be a challenge, but again, I don't think it's a technology issue, right? I feel like this may be onset of something bigger, in the sense it is easy to understand the current environment at a university because it's open. The fact that there is a situation going on, whether it is a political situation or a education situation or a health situation, it's a lot more easily available than what is going on within a company. So being able to use that as a mechanism to go create the phishing email so that there's a higher chance of being successful. I think what we need to aim to is, you know, the takeaway from me from this is attackers are getting more contextual. Attacks are getting more contextual in the phishing email. So we need to do a better job of, number one, educating and creating the education material, which is more contextual, and increase the rigor of testing with penalties to say, if Jeff clicked on it, in the penalty box for 20 minutes, right?
Sorry, Jeff.
Right? sorry, Jeff, but I got to put somebody in the penalty box.
That's
right?
All right. If anybody deserves it, it's me, so I'll go.
So we got to put, like, you know, and but at the same time, I'm talking about improving the technology of doing a better job of monitoring if somebody's cutting through the gate all the time, cutting through the fence all the time, do a better job of monitoring it, as an example, right? Do a better job of making it tougher and tougher and tougher, because we as human beings don't seem to learn. Even after this many years, less than 10%, it just makes me sad.
Michelle, final thoughts.
Great. Thank you. Lots of pressure there with final thoughts.
Take your time. No pressure.
I've got something. You know, based
it's
on...
It's got to be you, because I'm in the penalty box.
You're silenced. Just kind of going off of what both Jeff and Sridhar said, one size doesn't fit all when it comes to education. So really understanding your threat landscape, and again, I guess I'm talking to all the organizations out there, but actually also on a personal level as well, knowing what is your likely target and threat landscape in terms of who is going to target you, what types of attacks. So the example given with regards to this campaign against the universities, do the HR and payroll departments of universities understand that this is happening? Do they have this type of threat intelligence that's disseminated to them? And is it incorporated and integrated into their cybersecurity training program? So if you're being trained on something that's likely not going to happen in your environment, then maybe you need to reassess what your training program looks like.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining me, Michelle, Sridhar, and Jeff. Also, thank you to all our viewers and listeners. Subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found, and stay safe out there.